Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Matt, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
You know, I was having a conversation a couple days ago. You actually came up, to be honest, man, because I recommend your interview to people all the time. You an interview on the Maverick Show, and it was pretty recently. I would encourage everybody that's listening to this to go check it out because it was really, really substantive. I mean, we spoke for a couple hours. I broke it into two parts. I just recommended it to some people. I was having a conversation the other day, and I was talking about some of the themes that we had discussed in that interview. And, you know, one of the things that I was talking about was, they asked me about, my perspective on some things. And I started going into this, what we started this interview with was my Irish heritage, right? And so we were talking about like the dynamics of whiteness in the United States and racism and all these different dynamics. And I said, one of the things that, you know, in terms of me, in terms of the way that I have started to think about these things is, you know, that connection with the Irish heritage and the way that, like, you know, a lot of these things start to fall by the wayside in terms of like understanding whiteness as an artificial colonial construction of dominance. And actually, if you go all the way back, you see that the British were colonizing the Irish, and then the Irish were involved in this anti-colonial resistance. And still today, people that look as white as anybody else actually have these anti-colonial politics, right? And so that sort of, I think, for me, has been really a moral kind of baseline and understanding that anybody in the world, it doesn't matter who you are, where you're born, or what your, you know, background is, you can take a stand for a just position.
How you day? That was the voice of Matt. Matt and I had a very, very fun conversation. I always love conversations that start with identity. You know, some of you are on the quest to figuring out a big part of your identity that you feel like has been missing for so long. Some of you have had a strong sense of identity since you were born, and some of you are in the middle. Regardless of where you are in the identity journey, there's an interesting pivot that it can cause in your life. It can cause you to have a different worldview, to reflect on the worldview that you feel like was imprinted on you, or to go down a different career path. And we talk about this and much more, entrepreneurship, real estate, being location independent with Matt on the podcast. So I really hope that you are reflecting on who you are as a person and who you want to be. I believe that's the journey of life, figuring out who you are as a person and ending up where you want to be, ultimately at your best self. That to me is the idealized journey of who you can be. So as you listen to this episode, I always tell people to take notes. Please share with your friends and your family, and do me a favor and leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Spotify, please. Apple Podcast, please. Anywhere. Acast, please. It is much appreciated. The reviews and ratings help the show in terms of visibility. With that being said, enjoy the episode. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of As Told by Nomads, and today's guest is Matt Bowles. Now, Matt Bowles is the co-founder of Maverick Investor Group, and he started that in 2007 as a fully remote real estate brokerage to help you buy turnkey rental properties in the best U.S. real estate markets from anywhere in the world. Matt and his co-founders at Maverick have helped individual real estate and investors to buy over, get this, $100 million dollars in residential investment properties across 15 United States. I'm sure those states are going to continue to grow. We're going to dive into that in the podcast. But the thing about Matt is I came across him because I was a guest on his podcast. And that's right. He's the host of the Maverick Show podcast, where he talks about his adventures in real estate and investing, as well as traveling. And I'm really excited to have him on the show because we're going to have a wide-ranging conversation about the world and entrepreneurship and everything in between. Welcome to the show.
Tayo, I am so excited to be here, brother.
Ah, the pleasure is mine. So I have an interesting question for you. Through research, I found that you studied abroad in Ireland in your junior year in college. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's correct.
So I'm very curious. You know, the Irish are known for their pub culture. Is there any pub that brings sweet, sweet memories for you as you think about what you were doing in Ireland junior year in college?
Like a particular pub in Ireland, you mean?
I could be. Or any experience.
I could just name something like Fitzsimons and Temple Bar, you know, or something like that if people know Dublin. But yeah, it was a really impactful year for me because that was my first year living outside of the country. And I had not traveled outside of the country very much prior to that. And I decided to study abroad and it was an entire year. And I lived in Dublin, was based there, went to Trinity College, but got to travel all around Ireland. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple really amazing and impactful things about that year, in addition to just being on your own in another country in your early 20s in that college age, which were, number one, I'm Irish American. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably about four generations in the U.S., though. And so what happens when you're that many generations into the U.S. is a lot of that Irish cultural heritage and political history gets sort of lost and evaporated, and you just kind of morph into like a white American who maybe has some distant semblance that they're Irish and St. Patrick's Day and something like that. But you really kind of get removed from a lot of that political history. And so when I went there, I lived there and I studied politics and I studied history, and I happened to be there in 1997-98, which was the year that they negotiated and signed the Good Friday Peace Accords. And so I followed that in the newspaper every single day. I was in Belfast the day that they signed the agreement. I got to meet a lot of the people that were involved with it. And so it was a really transformative year for me also to just reconnect with that Irish history, you know, and those anti-colonial politics of the Irish, obviously being the first British colony. And that really helped, I think, shape a lot of my worldview and my political trajectory going forward.
So you get to reconnect with your identity. And then you talked about Ireland being the first British colony. I don't know that a lot of people know that.
I mean, and if you read the history, what you'll find if you've studied any of the other British colonies, obviously, you're very familiar with Nigeria.
Yeah, and I lived in, I'm from one.
you know, man. And yeah. So what you find when you study Ireland is that a lot of these colonial techniques were developed over the Irish. And then they went to the rest of the world and, you know, did all of it and worse and more and at greater scale all around the world. But if you study that, you will find that a lot of this stuff was first done over the Irish in terms of how that settler colonial process would work. And what you then also find is that the anti-colonial solidarity in Ireland is among the most profound that you will find around. So if you go to the north of Ireland in particular, which is still under British occupation, the northeast six counties, you will find Palestinian flags flying all over the place. You will find murals to, you know, Nelson Mandela and like all, like you will find all of this there because there is a shared history of colonization and, you know, and decolonial resistance. And so it was just remarkable and really important, I think, for me to be able to see that history and immerse in that and reconnect with those politics.
Yeah. You know, it's always interesting what happens when you really reconnect with your identity. And so, but for you, it played an interesting role because my understanding is that you got your bachelor's in sociology and then your master's in international peace and conflict. So you got a real start into that, you know, like the lived experience your junior year in college. And then you went on to be in a nonprofit world until you were 30. What was that like?
Yeah, it was kind of one thing after another. You know, I mean, I think politically speaking, in terms of consciousness, like the first thing I really connected with sort of high school era going into college was the African-American struggle. And that largely my awareness got raised about that through hip hop music, because I started listening to Public Enemy and political hip hop artists. And then I got very interested in the history of the African-American struggle. Then I get to college. And then my advisor in the sociology department was Native American. So I'm taking his Native Nations classes. I'm learning about the genocidal processes over Native Nations. And then he was the one that said, hey, when you go to Ireland, pay attention to the colonial processes over the Irish. Let's do some, you know, some comparative work on British colonial processes over the Irish compared with over native nations. And so we did that. Then from there, I did a semester and I studied the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I went to the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, Israel, and Egypt. And then again, I did with my advisor comparative work on the colonial processes over Palestinians compared with colonial processes over native nations. And so it was kind of one step after another. And then after I did all that, I was like, you know what? I think I'll just do a master's degree in international peace and conflict resolution. And I was doing activist work around Palestine. I was doing activist work around the north of Ireland. I went down to Chiapas, Mexico, spent some time with the Zapatista movement and all of that kind of stuff. And then once I finished the degree, I was like, well, what do I do now? And I did a little bit of labor organizing for a while. And then I had been doing a lot of Palestine solidarity work. So I was very deep in that community. And then that was when September 11th happened. I was in Washington, D.C., and the aftermath of that was just remarkable in terms of like how draconian and repressive the U.S. government's domestic response was in terms of targeting Arabs, Muslims, South Asians, all that. And so I was already very deeply connected with those communities through my Palestine work. And so the American Civil Liberties Union, for the first time in their 80-year history, decided that they were going to start a field organizing department and start doing grassroots organizing in addition to their legal work and their lobbying work that they've been doing for decades. And I was one of the first four grassroots field organizers hired by the American Civil Liberties Union specifically to do grassroots organizing around post 9/11 civil liberties abuses. So I was in Washington, D.C., and I was doing that for many years. And it was an incredibly rewarding and powerful experience.
Wow. Wow. I mean, I can see how that can shape your worldview, for example, because, you know, you have the awakening in Ireland, you get to even dive into the culture, you come back, you have incredible teachers, it sounds like, and role models who are able to guide and help you, you know, come up with your own understandings of things that you might have been taught, you learn, you unlearn, you relearn. And then in the nonprofit world, this is something that I've had a few guests on, and I've definitely had my experience with the nonprofit world, but there's always this idea of doing social good, but then this starving artist mindset. So how did you reconcile this idea of wanting to make a living for yourself while feeling like you can actually make money at the same time? Because sometimes some people feel like they're against each other, those things. But I think you found a way to fuse those concepts.
The first piece of that answer is that I was before I got a job in the nonprofit space, I was a student who is spending as many of my waking hours as possible doing volunteer activist work, right? Whether it was trying to stop the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal or protesting the IMF World Bank, you know, stuff, or, you know, doing Palestine solidarity work or whatever it was. And that was just all volunteer stuff I was doing on my time. So when I got hired by a nonprofit and they're like, we're going to pay you a salary with benefits to do the type of work that you've already been doing, but now you can make a living from it. I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, this is blissful. This is like incredible. I'm like blown away that like someone's going to like cover my, you know, expenses to go fly here and speak and give me control over what I say. And I get to do political organizing and get paid for it. Like, that was amazing because it really was like where my heart was. And I really felt like I was doing really, really important work, particularly in that post 9/11 era.
Of course.
And it was incredibly rewarding and it was blissful. And for many years it was blissful, but ultimately, I mean, what ended up happening, we had a change in management and different stuff got shaken up. And so I left the organization, moved out to LA, took a different job. And then that job didn't work out. So what had happened, though, while I was working in the nonprofit space is I did start to realize what you were saying, right? Which is that I'm never going to make a lot of money doing this. I'm kind of getting this trade off where I get to do what I love and I kind of get my basic living expenses covered. Right. And so somebody was like, oh, you know, you should buy a house. And I'm like, can I buy a house like on a nonprofit salary? Like, oh, yeah, here's how you do it. This and that. It's like, OK. So I looked into it. Sure enough, I buy a house and I buy a 4-bedroom house and I rent out 3 of the bedrooms to friends of mine. Right. So I have 3 streams of income. I'm living with 3 friends of mine. So it's a great, really fun group house. It's in a very cool neighborhood in D.C. And then that year, my house appreciates more in value than my entire annual salary. And I was like, that's interesting. You know, so you're telling me I could have just sat on my couch and played video games all year and not worked and made more money. That's a pretty interesting concept. So then what I did is I started reading everything I could read about real estate. And then I was able to just use some of that equity to buy additional rental properties, but in out of state markets, right? So I started learning about this. And then what happened is friends started coming up to me and they're like, dude, how are you buying this real estate? You know, you work at a nonprofit, like, how are you doing this? And I was like, oh, let me show you. I'll show you what I'm buying and you can buy similar stuff to me. And so what I realized as I was doing this was that the real estate brokers that were helping us to buy this real estate were making commissions off of the properties that we were buying, but we were not paying them because in the United States, the sellers pay 100% of the real estate commissions and buyers pay nothing. So that's a really cool deal. Like they're providing all this value to us, helping us find these properties and we don't have to pay them for it. Like that's a really cool deal. And so what happened fast forward is when I moved out to LA and then my job didn't work out, I get fired from my job. I'm 30 years old. I'm like, what do I do now? And on that day, it was a very dramatic day because it was a surprise. Like, I didn't know they were going to let me go. And it was a meeting and they're like, yeah, you got to be out by 5 and whatever. And you give us your phone. It's a work phone. And so I'm literally driving to the Verizon cell phone store with no phone.
Yeah.
To buy a phone so I could call my mother to tell her I got fired. Right. And like on that drive, I'm thinking to myself, you know what? I think I'm not going to apply for another job. I think I'm going to figure out how to chart a different course and how to go the entrepreneurial route and start a business and create more autonomy for myself in my life. And then if I can build a business, then I can, you know, do activism on my own time. I can donate money to causes I care about. I can do all those things that I wasn't able to do in the nonprofit space. And so then I realized there was just one problem. I had no idea how to start a business, Tayo. So what I did was I bought the phone. I called my mom. I told her I got fired. And then I drove directly to the bookstore and I started reading books on how to start a business. And I drove every day to the bookstore in LA. And I just sat there reading books. I didn't buy the books, Tayo. I didn't have a job. I just sat there reading them in the bookstore. And then this was 2007. And then I would look at the new business books first thing when I walked into the bookstore. And one day I walk in and I look on the shelf and there's a new business book that had just came out called The 4-Hour Work Week by some 29-year-old kid that nobody had ever heard of called Timothy Ferriss. And I picked it up and I read it the day it came out. And I was like, that is what I'm doing. So, and then the business model, I realized that I already had friends that were asking me how to buy real estate. They wanted to buy real estate. I was helping them to buy real estate. And what I realized from a business perspective was if I could simply get on the real estate brokerage side of this, get a real estate brokerage license, I could just continue helping my friends buy real estate, charge them nothing, and all of a sudden get paid the real estate brokerage, commissions and referral fees and stuff from the sellers in the same way those brokers were getting paid helping us without charging us anything. And so I was like, that's what I want to do because I don't like selling stuff. I particularly don't like selling stuff to my friends, but if I could help them for free and still make money, that's the business model for me. And then I started thinking, how would I build that in a way that's completely location independent and remote, you know? And so that was then the next phase of it.
So, I mean, you said a lot there and, you know, I want to go back to that firing aspect. I've been fired. And the first time I got fired, it was very similar. It was just, hey, you know, I'm sorry, we're letting you go. Don't make a scene. And I went back. My laptop was logged off. And I just remember just walking out in shame. And I just remember going home and feeling like this profound disappointment. This was in the middle of my MBA in New York when I came in. I was like, you know, I remember you going in a fetal position and crying, but like you, it was the same time that I launched my business because I started thinking like, oh, I gotta figure out this situation. So you go from that range of emotions. And some people listening will be confused by this idea of you having to go to Verizon to get a new phone. It was a very different time back then. And you did something that is remarkable. You decided to read books while you were there because you didn't necessarily have enough money to buy those books. And so I want to have the audience pause there and think about how even if there's a situation where it's tough for you to navigate and gain, you know, mentors from, you know, your literary giants, you can still find ways to do it. The library, the bookstore, you know, sitting down, finding different ways to, you know, ensure that you're using all those areas.
listening to podcasts, there's you know, YouTube University, as they call it, right? I mean, there's so much information out there now that you can find whatever you want to learn. If you're dedicated and committed to learning it, you can find it.
Yes,
for free.
Exactly. And so then the 4-hour work week, which was, I remember when it came out, I read the book as well. And the revolution, you know, this is the genesis of Tim Ferriss becoming what he'll become. It sparks you into this entrepreneurship field where you focus on the location independent. Was location independent something that was big back then? This is 2007, right?
I'd never heard of it. That book was the first time I'd ever heard of it. Right. Mm. And so that's why I'm saying, so I was like, I saw that and I was like, this is the whole purpose of this, right? Like the whole book, what it did for me, the light bulb that it turned on was that if you're going to build a business, the purpose of the business should not simply be to make you money. It should be to facilitate your ideal lifestyle design, your freedom of mobility, the ability for you to move around the world and live in these ways that you want. And that's real freedom. It's not just making money and tying yourself to an office, right? And I was like, wow, that's incredible. And so understanding that, right, was, I think, the light bulb. And so then as I continue to read these books, I had another realization, Tayo. Once I understood like what it took to start a business, I was like, you know what? I don't have most of the skills that are required to start a business, but I know other people that have complementary skills to mine. And so I went out and I recruited two business partners that had very different and complementary skill sets. And the three of us came together, founded this company. I sent them both the book. I was like, read this book first. And then here's my idea for how we could build this, what we could all do, the roles we could play, and how we could build this business in a way that is fully remote and location independent and would allow us to live where we want, travel when we want, and, you know, do all of that. And so that was the genesis.
The art of finding a business partner is one of tremendous peril or success, right? This has been, you know, the genesis of great businesses is also the downfall of great businesses. How did you make sure that you actually found complementary partners and you didn't, you know, fall victim to all the, you know, the perils of a bad marriage?
So I have two business partners. One of them I knew from grad school. She did her master's degree in international peace and conflict resolution with me. She worked in a separate NGO in the nonprofit space, also in Washington, D.C., and had been doing that. And that was her entire career as well. And she and I had done a lot of activism work together. So we had taken, you know, international observers to the north of Ireland and been in like intense situations together and really stress tested a lot of things, really got to know each other's skill sets and really got to work in a complementary team oriented capacity in high intensity situations. And so I had years of trust there. And I also knew that she was outstanding at things that I'm terrible at. And I'm very good at things that she's not. And we know how to work together and, you know, to do that as a team. So that was someone I had known for a long time. And I was like, this would be the perfect person. So I just hit her up and I was like, I know you're doing great at your job, but how would you like to quit your job and come start a business with me? And she agreed. And then the other person was somebody that actually had real estate experience. And he was somebody that had sold me rental properties. And I was very impressed. He was one of the top salespeople at his company. And that was another of my greatest sales jobs, which is I went out there and I pitched him and I was like, listen, you know, we need somebody to come in immediately that's already a real estate broker, you know, because it takes, you know, to start from scratch, you got to be an agent for many years before you become a broker and then to do this. And I was like, we want to start a brokerage like immediately. And this is the business model. You could come in, be the corporate broker and play that role. And, you know, all of that real estate experience and everything, you know, that he brought to the table was totally different because we didn't have any professional like real estate sales experience of any kind. Right. Yeah. So the three of us just kind of brought very different things. And I knew them from different capacities in my life and had worked with them in different capacities. And I was like, this would be the dream team. And so I went out and pitched them and it worked. And 16 years later, we're still together.
Yeah. So no stepping in tone. It's very complementary skills, people doing what they're good at. And, you know, here you are $100 million in residential investment property later. What has been your favorite story that you've had so far since you started?
Man, you know, I mean, our clients are amazing. I think that just people come in with our entire framework for working with clients is this. We're not, one of the things that we're different from regular real estate brokerages about is that a regular real estate brokerage is very transactional, right? Yeah. You come to a broker, you're like, I want to buy a house to live in. They're like, okay, they find you the house, you buy it, you live in it, and then you're done. And you probably never see that person ever again. It's one transaction and it's done. Our model was like, no, we want to work with real estate investors over the long term to help them build a portfolio.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Portfolio of rental properties over time, diversify across real estate markets, you know, this kind of stuff. And that's our vision. And so we have everybody come in the door from day one, do a video consultation with us and talk to us about their personal financial goals, right? What is their buying criteria? What's their investment goals? Where would they like to be 5 to 10 years from now? And, you know, and so the fact that we have clients that are buying with us, you know, today, like just this past month, I had a client close on a property who has bought his first property with us probably 13 years ago, you know? And so those kind of stories about those long-term client relationships, I think are my favorites, man.
Now with real estate, you have a lot of, you know, stories like the older generation believed it was a means of gaining wealth. And now you have different styles, right? There's Airbnb, there, you know, the different ways people build multifamily to single family. But sometimes now, depending on what generation you are, there's this, it can be this overwhelm that comes with how much down payment you have. Is there a myth with that? Do you have to have a certain down payment, like 20K, I think is what people always say. Do you think that that's true, or can people start with much less than that?
So with a rental property, there is a different, you know, a different set of criteria than with a single family home that you're planning to live in as a primary residence.
Okay? Yeah.
So with a rental property, it is a 20% down payment is the minimum if you're using a conventional mortgage.
From 20%. Yeah. Okay?
20% down. And so therefore, depending on how much the property costs, you know, the properties that we deal with are certainly not in New York City or in San Francisco or in places like that. So we're not talking about those types of prices on purpose, because what we do is we identify what we call investor advantaged US real estate markets, which are markets that have uniquely advantageous price to rent ratios, right? So where can you buy relatively low, rent relatively high, and get a more optimized price to rent ratio than you could get in, say, New York City, right?
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of buyers that live in New York City or that live in LA or that live in these, you know, expensive markets, either because they love to live in those cities or they need to for their job or their family or any number of other reasons. But they realize that if they were to buy properties in Indianapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City, they could buy 10 houses for the price of one house in their own city, right? Or that's maybe amazing. even more than that, right? Because in these markets, you can buy a nice, fully renovated, detached single family home in a majority owner occupied suburban area for less than $150,000.
Stop it, Matt. Yo, that might scratch the bare minimum of a down payment for somewhere in Manhattan, maybe Queens. But seriously,
Okay, exactly. And so therefore, if you're buying a property that's $150,000 and you're putting 20% down, that's $30,000 down, and you have a 80% mortgage and you have your house.
And then you get a percentage of whatever they make on that, and then it goes from that way.
So the way that our business model works, again, we are a real estate brokerage. So we are introducing people to buying opportunities for what we call turnkey real estate. So this is actually
emphasis on turnkey.
this is a very important part of the like business turnkey model, right? This is not, you know, you're not buying fixer uppers, right? This is a situation where we are giving people the opportunity for an off-market buying opportunity for turnkey real estate, which means the properties are either brand new construction or they're fully renovated. They already have a long-term tenant in place on a lease, and they already have a local professional property management company that is collecting the rent, handling the maintenance, managing the property, which means that you can own it from anywhere. You don't need to live near the property, and you don't have to be the one who is the landlord and the rehabber and dealing with the tenant and all of that stuff, but you get all the benefits of owning the deeded real estate. So those are the buying opportunities that our clients get introduced to. When they close on their property, we get paid what's called a referral fee, which is like a commission from the seller, not from the buyer. So buyer pays nothing to work with us.
Okay. That sounds like a dream scenario. And it also sounds, based on my research, it sounds like a way you like to do business. Because my understanding is that your business is also socially conscious, correct?
Yeah, exactly, man. So we donate 10%. And we started this because, as I mentioned, like Valerie and I were both in the nonprofit advocacy space. We both did our master's degree together. Like, we come from that world. And we literally sat down and had this conversation. We're like, are we selling out if we start a business and like go the business route? Like, what kind of ethics are involved in that decision? And then we were like, let's talk through it. And we like, we really had a serious conversation. And it was actually quite like, a thing that I really thought a lot about and struggled with and tried to figure it out. And so what we came up with was this. We said, okay, listen, we can start a business and we will say that we will donate 10% of our net revenue, like before we take any money out of the company, pay ourselves as managers or owners, before we take any money out, we'll donate 10% of the net revenue to causes that we care about. And that way we're contributing financially, which we were never able to do before if we're working for a nonprofit, and we're able to contribute financially. And we're also creating a financial incentive whereby the better the company does, the more money goes to these causes that we care about, right? And so that's kind of how I have, thought about this whole thing, in terms of, the purpose of the business, right? Like, one, it's facilitating my ability to be location independent and travel the world and be a full-time digital nomad, but also our staff, everybody that works for us, also location independent, and they can have their dream lifestyle, and we're facilitating other people being able to do that as well. Our customers, we're adding value. We're helping them build their wealth, build their passive income, and be able to design their dream lifestyles. So the more the more business we do, the more customers we have, the more people we're empowering in that way. And then finally, the more financially successful the business is, the more money it throws off to these nonprofit causes. So that was how we structured it from the get-go.
I love that. Where can people find your website? Just so that, if someone is probably going to say, I want to pause this right now and find out more about this opportunity with Matt.
Maverickinvestorgroup.com is the website. Yeah.
Okay. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes and then we'll circle back to this. But I want to pivot a little bit now to your location independence, right? So at this point, you've built a successful business, but from my understanding, you're not always in the United States. In fact, you're not in the United States right now. So
that is correct. I am in the Canary Islands, speaking to you just steps from the ocean, my friend.
Exactly. So how did you just talk to me about your travels? How did you just create this digital nomad lifestyle where you can still get your taste of your home country, but just, I guess, build a life elsewhere? Because some people, whenever we have these interviews, they always talk about, well, how do you find love? How do you build a relationship? Or do you feel disconnected from home? Like, there are multiple things that people have when it comes to this. So I'm curious from your perspective, how it's been for you.
So to be honest, I did not plan the lifestyle that I'm in now from the get-go exactly. And to give people context, I have now been a full-time itinerant digital nomad with no base for over 10 years.
10 years.
So 10 years. And so I will tell you how it started, though. So I told you that I read the 4-Hour Workweek in 2007, but my first, and that's the year we founded our company, but my first 6 years of location independence, I was based in LA. I was based there because I loved LA. I was in a relationship in LA. My partner was doing her PhD at UCLA, and we had no business in LA. We weren't doing any real estate in LA, but I just loved it there. So that was where I chose to be. And then we had been living together for like 3 years, right? And so then one day she comes home and she's like, yeah, so, and she was doing her PhD in Egyptian history. And she comes home one day and she's like, yeah, so I got to go to Cairo for a year to do my dissertation research. And I'm like, cool, I'm location independent. Let's go to Cairo for a year. And so we got rid of all of our stuff in LA and we went to Cairo for a year. And at the time I was thinking it would just be for the 1 year. I wasn't thinking anything more than that. But then we get to the end of that year. And then I was like, you know, you've got now an entire year to write this dissertation. We don't need to be in LA for that. You have all your research with you. I can work remotely. Why don't we just pull out a world map and pick the top 5 places in the world we most want to live and just go rent an Airbnb for 2 months in each place? So we were like Rio de Janeiro, Cape Town, South Africa, Barcelona, and we just went around the world. And then that ended up going for about 2 years, actually. So Egypt plus 2 years. So she and I actually, as a couple, traveled the world together for 3 years. So that was a significant part of my nomad journey, was doing it in a relationship. In a relationship. Part of the answer to the relationship question is have a relationship and travel the world together. I mean, that's, you know, that was the first 3 years of my experience. Then we broke up in 2016, and all of a sudden now I'm single. And then I got to figure out, well, now what? Because that was, you know, I traveled the world with her. So we had each other. Now I don't know anybody. I just get out of, it was at the time, it was a 7-year relationship that I had finally gotten out of. And I'm like, man, I need hugs. I need people. I need community. like, what do I do? And so I had actually heard about this program called Remote Year. And Remote Year, the company puts together these 12-month itineraries for remote professionals where you live in a different city each month for 12 months and you travel the world together as a community. Nobody knows each other beforehand, but you just show up and then you travel the world together for a year. And Remote Year takes care of all your accommodations, access to co-working spaces in every city. You know, they have local people on the ground that are helping to facilitate stuff to do and all that. So it was, I was like, that's perfect. Like, I need that. It's an immediate community. Nobody knows anybody. They're all there to form an intentional community. I'll be with them for the whole year. Sign me up for that. And so I jumped on Remote Year in 2016, flew to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and went around the world on 4 continents, 12 months. And, you know, everybody that finished that trip is family for life because we spent a year together. I just had a reunion with them a month ago in Mexico City, which was incredible. And then after that, I just started, you know, continuing to travel the world, plugging into different work travel programs, nomad events, you know, different things, and started kind of learning about that. And then just, you know, traveling all over the place. So I've now been to probably in the last 10 years, almost 70 different countries that I've lived in, worked in, and run the business from.
That's wild. Do you plan on visiting more countries? Are you one of those people that wants to do the entire world by the time you die?
I mean, I'm not particularly motivated by the country counting thing. I go back to a lot of countries. I mean, I'm in the Canary Islands now. I've been here before. You know, I go back to a lot of countries that I've been to. I mean, as you know, like I spent about 7 months on the continent of Africa, and I only went to 2 new countries this year. So I went to Angola and I went to Rwanda, but the rest of the time it was just, I went back to Nigeria, I went back to Tanzania, I went back to Ghana, I went back to Senegal, I went back to South Africa. I've already been to all those countries before, but I love them and had different reasons to go there. And so, you know, I kind of returned to a lot of these. So I'm not like trying to race and count all these countries. And I do not have a quantitative motive. I have a qualitative motive to my travel, shall we say.
Fair enough. Fair enough. In terms of favorites so far, because you say you go back a lot, which ones would you say are your top five?
Top five what?
Countries, cities. Sorry, let's go with cities, because countries could be
cities in the
general.
World.
Yeah, in the cities world? In the world that you visited.
Man,
hey, you had me do top five. You had me do
that
a list.
True.
Of hip-hop artist.
True, man. That is
you didn't
true,
think I was
bro.
Gonna find a way to bring a list to you?
That's true, man. Oh boy, let's see. Well, I am on my way to Brazil, and I will tell you that that is definitely up there in my top five. No question. The country of Brazil. Every time I go to a different place. They're all different. I love them all. If I had to pick a city, I'd probably pick Rio because I've spent the most time there, but I also love other ones like Sao Paulo, but let's go with Rio. I would then pick a country, jeez, man, a city. Let's go with in Asia, I will pick Tokyo. Because that city is just bananas. I mean, there's nothing like Tokyo. I mean, it's its own planet. You just have to go there to experience it. So, and the food is also just going to change your entire impression of like food on the planet of Earth. Like once you eat food in Tokyo, you'll be like, oh, there's
what
levels.
What levels. Is everything else?
There's levels to this. So I'm going to say Tokyo, Rio, and then I will pick... Oh, man. I mean, the continent of Africa, there's so many cities that I love, man. I mean, since I'm doing this with you, bro, I feel like I should pick Lagos, man.
No, you know, you should pick what you
like
want
I
to
should
pick.
Lagos. Bro, you know, I can't pick, like, I got to be careful if I'm picking anything outside Nigeria with you.
Oh, no,
you know,
I'm not going to pick anything.
You do know I spent a month in Lagos, and we talked about it. And it was very impactful. It was very special. I think the art, the music, you know, that's coming out of Nigeria is it has genuinely like it has become such a central part of my life. I listen to Nigerian Afrobeats daily. I mean, I put people onto it. My parents are listening to Nigerian Afrobeats.
That's amazing.
In their mid 70s. They are playing Burna Boy. They're talking to their friends about Burna Boy. Like,
let's
I mean,
go.
Bro, it is a central part of my life. So in terms of the cultural influence, Nigeria, like it genuinely, it really stands out. And I had such a special time there. Although I could probably pick other places on the continent too. You know where I just went last year that I was so enamored with was Johannesburg in South Africa. I was, because, you know, I had spent a bunch of time in Cape Town and it's lovely. But I had never been to Joburg, and then I went to Joburg, and I was like, "Oh God, this is a different type of situation, man." And I was I was so enamored with it. So let me put people onto Lagos, Joburg, Rio,
Tokyo,
and then I'm gonna put I'll put Bangkok in there.
Bangkok
is just it's just a unbelievable city. I mean, the energy is just electric, and it is just a really, really, really special place. So I'll go with those five.
No, I appreciate you, you know, engaging with me in that. But you know, I was curious. I had the mind that I was going to find a list, but I was going to do it in real time. And once you said you had a few favorites that you're going back to, I was like, there it is. So, but no, those are amazing countries. And definitely, I know that I've only been to the airport in Tokyo, and I've always wanted to go. But I have been to Bangkok. Obviously, Lagos, where I'm from, and you know, I haven't gone to Joburg, and Brazil has been like a dream destination for me. You know, even my heritage, I'm Yoruba. There are a lot of, you know, obviously because of the transatlantic slave trade, a lot of you know, remnants of part of my culture there. So I'll be very curious to go to Rio at some point.
Well, and I'm going to Salvador de Bahia, you know, this on this boat trip. You know, the Nomad Cruise ends there, and that is the capital of Afro-Brazilian culture.
Of course.
And I have not yet been there, and everyone who has been there has just raved about it. They're like, you gotta go. And now that I've spent so much time, I probably spent 6 months in West Africa, as you know.
Yes.
And so now going there, you know, I'm just like, man, I'm so excited.
I'm excited too. Well, the thing about you though, because when you talk about travels, is it true that you call yourself the stylish minimalist?
That's how I pack, man. That is my packing routine. You know, I started off carrying an enormous amount of stuff and lugging huge suitcases across the world. And then I was like, there has got to be a better way. And so I started studying minimalist packing, and I started saying, how can I travel the world full time to multiple climates with carry-on luggage only?
Carry-on? You're talking about I heard you say this, and I couldn't register. I'm talking about you're going to different climates and you're saying everything still fits in the carry-on and you can do that for weeks.
Bro, I do it full time, not for weeks. I don't have a base.
Sorry.
The only things I have in this world fit into my carry-on suitcase. I'm a full-time digital nomad. I do not have a base. And my carry-on includes an espresso maker, a wine aerator, a three-piece suit. And then, yeah, I can go skiing. I can go to the beach. I can do all that stuff, man. And I never check a bag.
Well, I mean, you don't wear the same clothes. Yeah, like, what do you do for clothes? You can't. That's not what you're wearing every day. You're not in a three-piece suit right now.
That's correct. There's a technique to this, my friend. I actually, and I will tell you this, and I will give your audience this. I have actually recorded a free video training on exactly what I pack, a full luggage audit, how I pack, what I pack, what's in my suitcase, and the sort of principles of how to think about it. Because I don't assume that everyone's sense of, you know, style is exactly the same as mine or that their priorities are the same as mine. They might not need a professional podcasting studio or an espresso maker or things like that, but they might have other priorities that they want to put in their carry-on. So that's cool. And so if folks want that, I have created, a bunch of free stuff like that. And they can get it at, if they go to themaverickshow.com/Tayo. I have some free stuff there for them. They can get the minimalist packing training, and I'm going to put some other cool stuff up there if they're interested in the real estate stuff or the remote entrepreneur stuff or any of the stuff that we're talking about. I'm just going to put free goodies there, and they can go there and check it all out for free.
I love it. Thank you so much. And again, we'll put all these links in the show notes. If you want to work with him on your real estate, it'll be there. And then he's been so generous to give the audience some free goodies here. I always wrap up my interview with this question because it's, you know, it's my mission statement reframed as a question. So, Matt, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
You know, I was having a conversation a couple days ago. You actually came up, to be honest, man, because I recommend your interview to people all the time. You did an interview on The Maverick Show, and it was pretty recently. I would encourage everybody that's listening to this to go check it out because it was really, really substantive. I mean, we spoke for a couple hours. I broke it into two parts. I just recommended it to some people. I was having a conversation the other day, and I was talking about some of the themes that we had discussed in that interview. And, you know, one of the things that I was talking about was, they asked me about, my perspective on some things. And I started going into this, what we started this interview with was my Irish heritage, right? And so we were talking about like the dynamics of whiteness in the United States and racism and all these different dynamics. And I said, one of the things that, you know, in terms of me, in terms of the way that I've started to think about these things is, you know, that connection with the Irish heritage. And the way that, like, you know, a lot of these things start to fall by the wayside in terms of like understanding whiteness as an artificial colonial construction of dominance. And actually, if you go all the way back, you see that the British were colonizing the Irish, and then the Irish were involved in this anti-colonial resistance. And still today, people that look as white as anybody else actually have these anti-colonial politics, right? And so that sort of, I think, for me, has been really a moral kind of baseline and understanding that anybody in the world, it doesn't matter who you are, or where you're born, or what your, you know, background is, you can take a stand for a just position in every struggle, right? You can pay attention. And in some cases, you know, you might be able to, like I did, trace back your heritage. You'd be like, oh, actually, there is this cultural tradition of quote unquote my people, you know, the Irish that did all of this stuff. And it wasn't just me, some random white dude in the United States just saying, I reject all this stuff. Like, there's actually a cultural tradition of that, right? But it, you know, whatever your background is, I think, you know, you can take a stand for a just solution, and you can just pay attention to which groups are being treated unfairly or being bullied in our invulnerable, marginalized positions. And how can you stand up and support those groups? And it doesn't have to be related to your own history. You know what I mean? Like the Irish history, I can be like, okay, there is this kind of proud tradition I can plug into. But if I didn't have that tradition, I would just take those positions anyways, because they're the morally upstanding position to take. And so, I mean, I try to have those conversations with people all the time. And depending on who they are and what their cultural traditions are, oftentimes there is a, you know, like in my Irish case, a proud, you know, tradition of their people, you know, taking stands for justice and doing things that they can align with. And even if there's not, then they can just, you know, take it on moral principle anyways. And so I try to have those kind of conversations with people. That's one of the ways that I try to contribute and make a difference.
But there you have it, Matt Bowles. This has been so fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed just diving into your origins and then just how your worldviews and the transformation of just yourself from, you know, an employee to an entrepreneur. It's been really fun.
Bro, I appreciate it so much, man. And if folks enjoyed this conversation, I really encourage you to listen to The Tables Being Turned and Tayo and I talking with me interviewing him on my show. You can find The Maverick Show wherever you are listening to this episode. Just type in The Maverick Show with Matt Bowles. You'll find the show and just scroll down and you'll see Tayo's picture there and you can click into the episode. And then again, if you want any of that free stuff, I'm going to put the minimalist packing video. I'll put a free training on building a location independent business, the real estate stuff, or any of that stuff, just go to themaverickshow.com/Tayo and you'll see it all there. We'd love to hear from people.
Make sure again to put all these in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been really, really fun. And kings, queens, and royalty, till next time, use a difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.